Hello and welcome to Canary Pod, a podcast from the team behind the Canary. I'm Kerri-Anne Mendoza, the Canary's co-founder and editor-in-chief. Each week we bring you a look behind the scenes at the biggest stories of the last 7 days. Today it's planes, buses and UN verdicts. We'll be taking a look at how the UK government is treating citizens and would-be citizens with far less than civility. Walking us through the stories will be the Canary's weekend editor, Tracy Keeling, and journalist, Steve Topple. Welcome both.
Hi.
Hello.
Steve, let's start with you. You've been reporting the damage austerity has inflicted on disabled people for absolutely years, but it's starting to feel like things are escalating. And a few stories, actually, that you wrote in the last week have been following that escalation. Can you lead us through those?
Broadly overall, I think we need to be asking ourselves a question, and that question is, have we as a society and the impact that government policies have now had, have we gone too far for disabled people actually to ever recover from this? Mm-hmm. And I think there's three stories that I wrote this week which we can kind of encapsulate into one and which sum this up. So first of all, at the start of the week, I wrote about how the government and the Department for Work and Pensions specifically spent £39 million last year having to defend its decisions to sanction people's benefits.
Yeah.
Now, there's a lot of controversy surrounding sanctions. The United Nations has described them as punitive and that they have severely impacted on the claimants' mental health, their physical well-being, and aspects of their financial well-being, specifically plunging people into poverty.
Yeah.
And after an investigation by the Independent and Freedom of Information requests from them, they found out that they spent £22 million dealing with people appealing a sanction decision in-house. And then they spent £17 million, and this is kind of where the stinger is, if you like.
Yeah.
They spent £17 million fighting sick and disabled and unemployed people in the courts over their sanction decisions. Now, to put this into some sort of context, last year, the Independent also had figures released for how many sanctions decisions were overturned. 67% of the DWP sanctions figures were wrong, basically.
Wow.
To relook and overturn 67% of them. And in total, since 2012, when the new rules about sanctions came in, a fifth of all DWP decisions have been wrong. So essentially, the DWP is sanctioning people. People are appealing,
yeah,
and they're then having to backtrack. And they're spending massive amounts of money in terms of, firstly, the DWP's budget, and secondly, in terms of how much money the DWP actually, inverted commas, saves,
yeah,
from sanctioning people dealing with people who are appealing the decisions. Again, if you just one other context to put it in, on average last year, the amount of money that sanctions to employment and support allowance ESA claimants, mm-hmm, saved was £31 million, and yet they spent £39 million overall fighting appeal decisions.
So they're literally spending more fighting decisions than they're saving creating the catastrophe in the first place.
They are. I mean, the National Order Office itself, yeah, said last year that overall sanctions for every welfare payment, when you put it all together, actually cost more than it actually saves. And that's the National, yeah, Order Office. That's not me totting up figures at home. That's the official government body who gives oversight to what the Conservative government is spending on. So it's the most preposterous system.
Yeah, and obviously it's not the first time this has happened either with the DWP, is it? There's several other instances. I think Workfare was a similar one where there was more money spent trying to implement it and fight court cases than was saved in people, mm-hmm, moving out of the benefit system. It gets worse, doesn't it, Steve?
It does get worse. I mean, the next story I wrote on was about a very well-known disabled rights activist, a lady called Paula Peters, and she told me her story about the discrimination and abuse she received on public transport. It took her over a week to actually pluck up the courage, if you like, to report on this,
yeah,
because firstly, she knew she'd probably get some backlash for it, and secondly, because she was concerned that she's calling out, if you like, public transport and public transport workers, which her and us, as people who lean to the left of politics, should,
yep,
be naturally,
yep,
supporting. But again, the story was shocking. The long and the short of it is she claims that a bus driver, as she got into a bus, allegedly said effing disabled people shouldn't be allowed on the bus.
So this is the driver of the bus, yes. as Paul is trying to get on the bus, yes. basically swearing under her breath and saying disabled people shouldn't be on buses.
Essentially, yes. What happened was Paula suffers from POTS, which is postural tachycardia syndrome. It's it's a condition which means that when you change from a position of laying or sitting down to standing up or vice versa, it causes a massive increase in heart rate, which can lead to fainting, dizziness, or someone passing out, and it also causes severe discomfort. Paul also lives with rheumatoid arthritis, excuse me, and fibromyalgia. So she walks with a tri-rollator, which is a three-wheeled support instrument, if you like, which doctors have said she has to walk with all the time when she's out in case she does collapse. So Paula goes to the bus, went into a accessible wheelchair space on the bus with her tri-rollator so she could stand up during the journey so she didn't have to change position. The bus driver then went on to tell her that she had to move from that area because it was for wheelchair users only. Paula obviously questioned this.
What?
The bus the bus driver stopped the bus, went over to her and started basically telling her that she either moved or she would have to get off the bus. She then started writing down, obviously, the number of the bus driver and the bus itself. She got abuse from passengers on the bus, and she ended up getting off. Now, I took these accusations to Go Ahead, which is the parent company of Metrobus. Their response staggered me.
It seemed like almost like a copy and paste from the company guide.
It was, essentially. What they said was that... In layman's terms, they have policy surrounding wheelchair priority areas, and when they ask someone to move from them who is not a wheelchair user, if they refuse to do so, the driver has basically a right to ask them to either sit down or leave the bus. The problem with this is, and it plays into a whole issue that this country has with what is known as invisible illnesses. So the bus driver wasn't aware, and Go Ahead, even though I explained to them what Paula's condition was, were not aware of POTS and the fact that she needed to be in a maintained position, not sitting down or standing up, because otherwise it could cause her harm. And it just beggars belief that neither the bus driver was trained in this or the bus company were even aware. But the problem is it plays into the third article we're going to talk about and issue we had in society more broadly. And it's this increase in abuse and discrimination that disabled people are seeing across the UK in all areas. And it's an increase which has been more pronounced, if you like, in the past 2 to 3 years, I think.
I think it's not dissimilar to what we've seen with the scapegoating of immigrants for, this total, this made up stuff like benefit tourism and health, healthcare tourism, and the idea that you take people's frustrations about the outcomes of political decisions. The housing crisis we have is because of political decisions. It's not because we've got too many people, because we've got too few houses. And, various other things. And then you end up, all of that kind of fester and anger that people have about real issues is then just diverted into sort of nurturing prejudice against a group of people that have zero to do with it. And I think, really, this has happened to the disabled community too. And, the way that you had, right from the get-go, the coalition government, creating this narrative of we've got to end the something for nothing culture. We don't want to be supporting scroungers. I can't remember what the distinction of the two words was now. There was like the goodies and the baddies. And we're going to go after the baddies. And, declaring basically every single person that was collecting sickness or disability-related benefits was going to go through a work capability assessment. So the inherent, the implicit argument behind that policy is we don't believe you. We think a whole bunch of you are putting it on and we're gonna find out. And no surprise at all, I think it was 2011 to 2012, hate crimes against disabled people rose by 25% in a single year. Because of that non-stop background drumbeat of prejudice and suspicion. And so it should be no surprise to anybody that now, absolutely. Yeah, you know, the woman's, you know, trying to get on the bus and she's viewed in that cluster of people. It's like they become the untermention. You know, these are the unmentionables, these people who are somehow subhuman because, what, they require the support of the welfare state. It's, yeah. It's outrageous.
Absolutely. But the thing is, Kerri-Anne, you know as well as I do, this is classic othering by the establishment, which you see over decades and decades through history, whether it be communists in the 1950s, the black community, the LGBT community. It's classic othering to mask the flaws and mistakes in the system that we live under. And it just so happens that in this century, it's turned to disabled people and those foreign nationals and refugees.
Yep, agreed. And that's absolutely why we're focusing on this in today's show, because there's such an overlap. You know, and I think it's really important now that people start to see, for goodness sake, how many times are we going to fall for this? How many times is the establishment going to pull this divide and conquer trick and people are going to, you know, listen to it and turn against each other? It's crazy. Yeah. So, Steve, then we have the UN.
Yeah, this is something, it kind of, it still amazes me that I keep banging on about this, and it just seems relentless. This is now the fourth report in the space of 14 months that the UN has delivered, where it has chastised the Tories to such an extent that the chair of the committee of the UN Committee on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities said that this is the most severe report out of every single country it comments on that it's written in its 10-year history. Just to put that into some quick context, the UN was reporting at the same time as the UK on Argentina and Ecuador, countries that we in the West would consider not as developed as us, thinking as us, and yet the UK's own report is far more damning. Like I say, this is the fourth report in the year. Last week, this committee came out and said that the Tories had created a human catastrophe in this country, that the government had used misrepresented figures and basically smoke and mirrors to try and cover up what it had been doing. We now have the outcome of this, which was published late yesterday afternoon. Just a staggering report. It made over 90 recommendations to the UK. It had over 70 criticisms. And one point that all the media missed, it only made two positive comments about what this government was doing and how it was treating disabled people.
Right. Well, for the sake of balance, what were the two good things?
Do you know what? I can't even remember, Kerri-Anne. That's right. It was complimentary about, and it wasn't even about the Tories. It was complimentary about how the devolved administrations had been implementing. I'm not making it up. Sorry, not fake news. How the devolved administrations had been implementing certain policies to try and level the playing field, if you like. there was one particular area of the Treaty on the Rights of Disabled People, which it said the government had implemented, which it was pleased with, it put it in place since the last report. However, there were 70 areas where it either noted concern, it said it was concerned, or it was deeply concerned. And that's like a scale, if you like, of severity.
Right.
Noted concern, deeply concerned. Some of the major points were that the Tories had failed to implement specific disabled people's human rights into law, and that the Tories didn't understand these disabled people's human rights. Austerity was heavily criticised, resulting in high levels of poverty. Benefit sanctions were called out, cuts to legal aid, the fact that certain areas of housing policy, specifically like common areas and houses, were not even in line with the government's own Equality Act 2010. There was concerns over the fact that disabled children are still put in, quote, special schools, and they're not catered for well enough in mainstream education, accessibility on public transport. There was also a lot about hate crime, discrimination, about how most of the UK laws do not adequately deal with discrimination. They also pointed out that the justice system in the UK treated discrimination cases not as severely as it should be doing.
Wow.
systemic failures, that's their words, not mine, about disabled people accessing mainstream health service, and also the lack of disabled politicians and the barriers that still exist for disabled people to vote in elections and referendums. This was just a few of the points.
And again, this has been what I find interesting about this is nothing you're telling me in that is news. It's known, you know, for years we've been reporting these incidents. I mean, literally today we're talking about two stories which absolutely are in line with bullet points of the UN's criticism, you know, access to public transport, the impact of austerity, and you know, the rise in hate. Like, these are things that we've been covering like relentlessly since they were initiated in 2010. And it just strikes me as absurd that we're now in the situation where the UN has got to be pointing these things out. And it's kind of, I mean, if it's old news to us, it's got to be old news to the government. I don't understand where the change is going to come from.
This is the challenge. I'm quite often stumped for words, and it kind of just beggars belief, really, that we're in this situation. If you try and remove yourself from society, if you like, just for a minute, and take a step back and think about this.
Yeah.
This is the United Nations banging on four times in 14 months to the Tories. And every time the Tories have dismissed this, shrugged their shoulders, said, we don't recognise these findings. And the problem is, there is no recourse over this. UN cannot force them to do anything. One disabled activist said to me, which I quoted in an article, if this was a Middle Eastern country, the US would have invaded by now on humanitarian grounds. We are the first to damn other nations for human rights violations. Yeah. But what the hell are we going to do about it when it's in our own country? And you witness it in the media as well. I was watching persistently the news last night and watching my social media to see how other media outlets reported this story of the UN's report. None of them got it. Not even the BBC, who had a disabled journalist reporting on it, covered it properly. While the BBC, it was very good. They made sure the majority of the report was giving a voice to disabled people about their experiences. And they had the chair of the committee talking about her reaction to the report. The actual piece itself, it didn't cover the most severe bits of the report, like the impact of austerity, like the fact that the UN said that the Tories have got to repeal the reforms they made to personal independence payments this year, and also that they have to look at every other welfare reform since 2010 and do an impact assessment and revoke the laws if necessary. And this, just to note, this is the second time the UN has now said that they have to look at their welfare reforms and either revoke them or change them. This is not new either. BBC didn't report on any of this. The Guardian completely got the details of the report wrong. It said that it had made 60 recommendations when it made over 90.
Yeah.
The Mirror hadn't read the report. It didn't quote anything from the actual report at all. But this is the problem. The media latch on to disabled people's issues like it's some sort of novelty almost sometimes. Yeah. And they don't actually get to the heart of the issue. And this is frustrating in itself as well. Well,
it's kind of symptomatic of the sort of issue with centrists that we have full stop at the moment, isn't it? There seems to be bottomless pity but zero solidarity, which, you know, and nobody wants, you know, the disabled community doesn't want your pity. You know, these are just simply human beings who are looking to be respected and valued in the same level as other human beings. And there are really simple, pragmatic political steps, actual tangible actions that we can take to make that happen. You know, this is not whimsical or fantasy. These are very simple things that we could be doing to radically change the lived experience of disabled people in our country. And politicians are choosing not to take those actions. And they should be held to account for that rather than this sort of, you know, wishy-washy hands in the air stuff about, oh, isn't it terrible? Oh, you know, my heart bleeds. But, you know, things are complicated.
And this issue and the issue I spoke to of the media, it comes back to the question that I posed at the start of this conversation, which was, have we gone too far now for disabled people to ever recover from this? Because the mainstream media is sometimes so lapsed in its reporting of disability rights issues, and also the angles and the narrative that it gives to them, i.e., it never really presents it as how severe it actually is.
Yeah.
That then plays into public perception that it's not really that much of an issue.
Absolutely. I
tweeted last night, and I had quite a reaction to it, that I put that the public read these reports and they frown for a few minutes and they go back to watching EastEnders or football or whatever. And it's only really disabled people who are day in, day out giving a sh about disability rights issues. It was misconstrued by some people. I didn't explain myself particularly well. I think the challenge we have is that as a society, corporatist capitalism conditions the masses to have so much going on in their lives. We're all so consumed with work, with issues like going shopping, paying the bills, the stuff we have to watch on the telly, our social media. Mm. We're conditioned and we're consumed by our everyday lives that are now so busy and so full of other, in essence, nonsense, which in the grand scheme is irrelevant, that we don't have the capacity to really take on board the seismic nature of some things. Or if we do, we just want to block it out because it's so horrific. I mean it shows in, as a side note, addiction levels in developed countries now are spiraling out of control, and a lot of psychologists, as we've discussed before, Carrie-Anne, believe that's a reaction to capitalist society that we live in. But so the challenge is that it's not that the public don't care. I just think that people are so consumed with everything else that they cannot give it the attention it needs.
I think there are multiple things going on. I think you've highlighted one. You know, we've discussed before the whole shock doctrine, you know, idea that you just drop so many bombs simultaneously that no one knows quite which bombing incident to go and deal with. You know, I think that's the thing for people. You know, some people it's like, okay, right, I can't fight all of these austerity struggles, so I'm going to commit to, you know, food banks, you know, and then they're on that. And then other people, you know, are sort of dealing with the disabled stuff. But you're right, it still kind of feels like too small a pool of people. I think kind of the exciting thing that's happening there is I think more people are becoming politically engaged. And yes. I think once you've got people politically engaged, it's not very long before they start taking action, because, you know, it's a motivating kind of feeling to be, you know, angry or upset. I think you can quite quickly actually catalyse that anger and turn it into something useful. You know, turn it into some sort of productive action, because, you know, you're right. Actually, if more of us were paying attention, if more of us were actively involved and shouting very loudly about these things, and, you know, putting our body in front of the machine occasionally, you know, getting out there and hitting the streets on protests. It's actually surprising how quickly these things turn around. You know, this sort of, you know, if you think about how kind of quickly Thatcher was dismantled at the end, you know, seemingly impervious. And I feel, you know, at the moment with the Conservatives, this is not a strong party that we're up against. You know, this is a seriously divided party with a completely compromised Prime Minister who's literally only in her post because no one else wants it right now, because it feels like sipping from the poison chalice, you know. But really, if you were a Conservative right now, would you be thinking, yeah, now's the time to take over the party when we're completely destroyed in the polls? We've got you know, 2 years max from Brexit, at which point quite a lot of stuff's going to go tits up. This is not really...
And if I was Conservative right now, I'd be helping Theresa May's migration target of getting it to below £100,000 by emigrating.
Yeah, she could help, couldn't she? Just take a seat on the plane.
I'd be so ashamed, I'd be off.
Oh, that's superb. Oh, thank you, Steve, for running us through those stories. Those stories, if you want to read them in more detail, they'll be in the show notes on whatever podcast platform you're listening to us on right now. I'm conscious that it's been quite a heavy show so far, and we're dealing with some quite meaty issues, and I just wanted to bring things up a touch. We've got Tracy Keeling with us, who's the Canaries weekend editor for our UK section. And Tracy, please tell us about your hero pilot.
Yeah, the hero pilot. So we've just, as you mentioned, had quite a heavy chat about the government wrongs, but the hero pilot story is an example of a citizen, of somebody righting those wrongs or attempting to. So the government attempted to deport a man from Afghanistan on the 26th of August. His name is Samim Bigzad. He travelled to the UK from Afghanistan in 2015 because the Taliban threatened his life. So he made the arduous journey here and actually has family in the UK as well. His father's here, he's a British citizen.
And he's the primary carer for his father as well, is that right?
He is. He's the primary carer since he's been here. But the government decided to deport him anyway, regardless of the fact that he has family here and the fact that his life is under threat back in Afghanistan. But campaigners travelled to the airport on the day he was meant to be sent off. They're from the Kent Anti-Racism Network. And they tried to inform fellow passengers, as to what was going on. I think they'd approached the airport, the airline, prior to that to inform them what was going on, but also approached passengers on the day. And they hoped that the message would get through, that the airline staff would be made aware of what was going on. And they were aware in the end. So the pilot, as Samim was going on to the flight, came out and refused to take off because he said that somebody's life was at risk. That was what he was aware of. So, yeah, a great example of a person stepping up to, to right what the government was trying to do. But actually, Samim wasn't the only person that understood this week that they were potentially not welcome in the UK.
Yeah, I mean, there's been some crazy stuff going on. I mean, obviously, when Theresa May was in the Home Office, we had a number of highly controversial immigration decisions. But it feels like this has gone on steroids under Amber Rudd.
Yeah, it has. I think, last year, which of course was split between them, there were 12,000 people forcibly deported. But there some just really random stories as well. So there's one guy called Shane Ridge from Lancashire who was born in the UK, raised in the UK. His mother, however, was born in Australia because on a family holiday, so a kind of not an accident of birth, but she's a joint UK and Australian citizen because she was born over there, but lives in the UK. All he's from the UK. And he got a letter from the Home Office saying that, you know, you've got to leave. You've got to leave the UK voluntarily because you've no lawful basis to be in the UK. And
Jesus.
Complete surprise because he's lived here, grown up here, his family's here. And then another young man, so all of these examples are fairly young men. He was, his name's Brian White, and he was brought to the UK when he was 15 from Zimbabwe. He was adopted, and his family, his dad, I think, in particular, was a British citizen and moved back over here when Brian was 15. And he fairly recently applied to university, got a place at Oxford University, and when he was trying to sort out the finance for that course, he discovered that he didn't have the right to remain, permanent right to remain indefinite here in the UK. So he's now having to work to try and, you know, be able to take his place, which University have said they'll save for him, but also, you know, trying to get that a residency status so that he can continue his life that he's lived so far in the UK.
Don't you just think, what is the point?
The point is that there's an absolute recklessness, it seems, in terms of dealing with these people's lives and their circumstances. and a terrible coldness. Steve was talking about, you know, our treatment of people with disabilities.
Yeah.
That you can see echoes of that here, the way yeah. we're treating, like, again, Steve said, the other. So with Steve's stories, it was the other was people with disabilities. But here the other is people with either who come from other countries or have connections even just yeah. to other countries. And the othering of those, of how you how they're treated differently to British citizens, to UK citizens. But it also shows how ridiculously inept the system currently is.
Yeah.
Because already, and so all of these stories got publicity this week, and also the majority of them have public support for these people.
Yeah.
So as we mentioned, for Samim, campaigners went to the airport, the pilot stood up for him. In the case of Brian, a petition was started for the Home Office to do something about it, and 80,000 people signed it. So they all got support from the public.
Yeah.
And the government having to turn around and go, oh, right, we're a bit wrong.
Yeah.
So in the case of Shane, they've already said, I'm sorry, it was an error. You should never have been sent that letter saying that you're not welcome in the UK. And with Brian, they're saying that they're aware of the urgency of it and will try and resolve the situation. With Samim, nobody knows as yet. So the pilot obviously wouldn't let him on, and then he was returned to the detention centre. People expect another deportation.
I think what really struck me about this story was that I can remember, and you guys may have been writing around the same time and remember it too, there's a case a few years ago of the killing of Jimmy Mubenga. Can you guys remember this? And so this, you know, when I was reading your story, Tracy, about Samim, I was just thinking how differently life could have turned out for Jimmy Mubenga, you know, if people would have been there for him. So we had this chap, basically the Home Office was deporting him. Again, the deportation service had been privatised. So you've got these G4S goons, basically. They get him on the plane and choked him, basically. There's like four big burly guys on Jimmy, and he ended up suffocating and dying on the plane, surrounded by other passengers. You know, so this whole plane has watched while these group of G4S guys have, through their actions, ended up killing Jimmy Mubenga. And you know, this is a father, a husband. He hadn't done anything wrong. He hadn't committed any crimes. And I couldn't help reflecting when you were telling me this story and just thinking how, like, we're saluting these people, you know, the Kent Anti-Racism Group and the pilot for stepping up, but we actually don't know just what a difference they made by stepping up.
Yeah.
You know, no one thought Jimmy Mubenga was going to die when he got on that plane, but the same could have happened to Samim. And the idea that actually this time people said absolutely not, like, over our dead body are you going to get this guy on this plane, I just honestly, it brought me to tears when I read this story for the first time, because it was just like the absolutely physical embodiment of what we say about don't get angry, get involved.
Yeah,
you know, just like, it's our responsibility that man is not deported.
Yeah, it is. And I think a lot of the problems with, you know, the situation you just mentioned and the mass amount of deportations that are happening is that there isn't a massive amount of coverage or awareness of it.
Yeah.
So like we mentioned, 12,000 people last year forcibly deported. Do we have 12,000 stories of those people that are gone? No,
absolutely,
we don't.
Absolutely not.
So it luckily, in the case of Samim, that network, the anti-racism network, was aware of it, was working to try and help him.
Yeah.
The same with Brian, with the young man from Zimbabwe. Once people are aware and that pressure is applied, then a big difference can be made. But there are so many cases where we just don't know. It's all behind hidden doors.
Anyway, I think that's us just about drawing to the end of our time for today. So I want to say thank you, Tracy and Steve, for joining me. Before we go, conscious, we need to leave people with something they can do. Tracy, is there any direction you would point people wanting to get involved on the story that you've covered today?
So obviously, because Samim was based in Kent while here, it was the Kent Anti-Racism Network that got involved. Mm-hmm. But in whatever area you are in, there will be a similar network that you can get involved in and help to, you know, to protect such people. As we've mentioned, petitions will also help, also helped in some of the circumstances. So sign those at your will. But yeah, getting involved in local campaigning will probably help.
Brilliant. Thanks, Tracy. And Steve, what about you? What can people do to, you know, support, you know, basically stand as allies with disabled people in these moments? And if, you know, if we've got disabled listeners, what can they do to gain support if they're struggling right now?
Yep, very straightforward. You can support my friends at Disabled People Against Cuts. It's DPAC, D-P-A-C. You can find them on Facebook under DPAC, or the web address is dpac.uk.net. They are one of the few disabled people's organisations in this country which actually do proactive campaigning and demonstrations against the impacts of cuts and austerity and the eroding of disabled people's rights in this country. So support DPAC, please.
Brilliant. And I'd second that. I've been following the work of DPAC for years, and they're just such a phenomenal organisation of committed, like, extraordinary people. So do get in touch, lend them your support, become a part of DPAC. It's really well worth it. The positive, constructive human beings. Okay, thank you, Steve and Tracy. As always, folks, go to the show notes if you want to read any of those stories in more detail. That's us done for another week at Canary Pod. Please make sure you follow us at Canary Pod on Twitter and use the hashtag Canary Pod to carry on the discussion. We'll see you next week. Until then, remember, don't get angry, get involved.